This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Hello, and welcome to Audio Journal's look at history from all points of the globe, a program that reports on what has happened so we might consequently find out what could happen. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. I'm Doug Johnson, and for the next hour we'll explore Walter Camp and the birth of modern football, then six fun facts about the donut. Frozen mercury and 18-foot drifts surviving the cold storm of 1857, followed by Ida Mae Fuller gets the first Social Security check, then from sugar houses to the sugar trust, Boston's candy-colored history, and finally, a brief history of Friday the 13th. This first article is both timely and interesting. It's titled, Walter Camp and the Birth of Modern Football. It was written by Leslie Landrigan and published by the New England Historical Society. Leave it to a clockmaker named Walter Camp to turn a chaotic excuse for a brawl into a game of precision and time limits. We now know it as football. Camp starred in football for Yale just as the game came back into fashion in the 1870s. His real contribution to football, though, was in setting the rules over 15 years of meetings with collegiate athletic directors at a Springfield, Massachusetts hotel. Walter Camp was born in New Britain, Connecticut, on April 7, 1859, into the family that owned the New Haven Clock Company. Chauncey Jerome founded the company in 1817 and made a fortune by selling cheap clocks with brass works. A devastating fire and Jerome's own mistakes allowed his nephew, Hiram Camp, to take over the company. By the time Walter was born, the New Haven Clock Company was the world's largest clockmaker. When Walter Camp was a year old, the sport that would become football was banned by Yale, and a year later, Harvard would follow. It was then known by different names, but it resembled the medieval European sport of mob football. The game had unlimited players, and one of its few rules disallowed manslaughter and murder as methods of moving the ball to the goal. By the 19th century, mob football moved to college campuses as an intramural sport. Each college played by its own rules. A Harvard tradition known as Bloody Monday started in 1827 when the freshman class played the sophomore class. Winslow Homer illustrated the game in an engraving called Class Day at Harvard University in 1858. But the game evolved into an excuse for a brawl that usually ended with injuries. Under pressure from the surrounding towns, college administrators banned it. At that point, another version was becoming popular at East Coast prep schools. Called the Boston Game, it used the round, inflatable ball introduced in 1855. Graduates of Boston's elite prep schools played it. They called themselves the Oneida Football Club, which some consider the first organized football club. The Oneidas played pickup teams from 1862 to 65 on Boston Common. In 1925, surviving members of the club dedicated a small stone monument on the common. It claims the Oneidas never allowed a point. The inscription reads, "On this field, the Oneida Football Club of Boston, the first organized football club in the United States, played against all comers from 1862 to 1865. The Oneida goal was never crossed. By 1873, football returned to college campuses. On October 20th of that year, representatives from Yale, Columbia, Princeton, and Rutgers met at the Fifth Avenue Hotel in New York City. They intended to agree on the first set of collegiate rules. Harvard refused to participate because the soccer-based rule conflicted with the Boston game, to which Harvard had committed. The new rules spread quickly, though. Such was the state of affairs when Walter Camp entered Yale in 1876. Football was again becoming popular, and the rules were just starting to be codified. Camp was a star athlete who played halfback for the football team as an undergraduate and later as a medical student. He was named captain, a position equivalent to head coach at the time. He also became a member of the Intercollegiate Football Association, formed during his freshman year. 3 years after the Intercollegiate Football Association met in New York, the Massasoit House Hotel in Springfield, Massachusetts, hosted representatives from Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and Columbia to adapt rules based on rugby rather than soccer. That decision was just one step in the evolution of football that Walter Camp would so greatly influence. Camp would become a fixture at Massasoit House, bringing a technocratic approach that perfected the game step by step, year after year. The same kind of Yankee inventiveness that revolutionized clockmaking went into 15 years of refinements that resulted in America's most popular sport. As a senior at Yale, Camp prevailed at Massasoit House and cut the number of players to 11 from 15. That year, he also came up with the idea for a static line of scrimmage. In 1882, the Yale-Princeton game ended in a scoreless tie, and Camp revised the rule to require the offense to gain 5 yards in 3 attempts or give up the ball. He also added measuring lines to the field. The next year, he revised the scoring system. In 1883, Camp's medical studies were interrupted, and he ended up working for the family clock manufacturing business. He did maintain his interest in the workings of the human body and later developed a set of exercises for the U.S. military called the Daily Dozen. From 1888 to 1892, Camp was unpaid head coach at Yale while working for the family business. As an engineer, he understood the advantages of planning and specialization. Each Yale player trained for a specific role, including quarterback, which Camp invented, along with offensive signal calling. He borrowed mass production techniques from the clock company to shape the team's drills. From 1885 to the end of 1899, Yale won 46 straight games and outscored its opponents by 2018 to 29. For years, Camp and journalist Casper Whitney selected the annual All-American team, known as Walter Camp's All-American Team. For 42 years, he edited the yearly college football guide, and he wrote and spoke prolifically about the sport. By 1892, he had created the game we now know as football. At the age of 33, Walter Camp was called, quote, the father of American football. Camp had his critics. As Yale's head coach, athletic director, and spokesman, some viewed him as a self-promoter who compiled questionable statistics to support his views. He hoarded gate receipts for the football program at the expense of minor sports like wrestling and swimming, and he used an alumni-funded slush fund of $100,000 to pay for gifts and vacations for his star players. None of that could stem the rising popularity of football. Rivalries sprang up all over the country, usually culminating in the Thanksgiving Day game we watch today. As far back as 1887, Boston Latin High School and English High School of Boston faced each other on Thanksgiving, and they're still doing it every year. By the time he died in 1925, Camp had written 30 books and 250 magazine articles, creating the myth of football players' manliness and courage. His foundation has awarded the Walter Camp Player of the Year Award since 1967. No player from Yale has won the award. Walter Camp died on March 14, 1925. He was inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame as a coach in 1951. Here's a fun and interesting article, also written by Leslie Landrigan and published by the New England Historical Society. It's titled, Six Fun Facts About the Donut. What's not to love about the donut? Well, except what it does to your waistline. But there's a lot more to the tasty snack than you might think. Here are six fun facts about the donut. Number one, you say donut, D-O-U-G-H-N-U-T. I say donut, D-O-N-U-T. The word donut first appeared in print in 1803 in a cookbook, The Frugal Housewife by Susanna Carter. English cookbooks had previously included recipes for fried nuts because that's how the dough was shaped. Then, in 1809, Washington Irving explained the origin of the dough nut in his, quote, A History of New York from the Beginning of the World to the End of the Dutch Dynasty. Quote, Sometimes the table was graced with immense apple pies, or saucers full of preserved peaches and pears. But it was always sure to boast an enormous dish of balls of sweetened dough, fried in hog's fat and called doughnuts, a delicious kind of cake, at present scarce known in the city, excepting in genuine Dutch families. Number two, it didn't have a hole until a Maine ship captain put one in it. Captain Hanson Gregory in 1916 told a Washington Post reporter he discovered the donut hole when he worked as a 16-year-old crewman on a lime trading schooner. Quote, Now in them days we used to cut the donuts into diamond shapes and also into long strips, bent in half and then twisted, he said. I don't think we called them donuts then. They was just fried cakes and twisters. Well, sir, they used to fry all right around the edges, but when you had the edges done, the insides was all raw dough, and the twisters used to sop up all the grease just where they bent, and they were tough on the digestion. He decided a space inside the dough would solve the problem. So he took the cover off the ship's pepper box and cut a hole into the middle of the doughnut. He shared his trick with his mother, who lived in Camden, Maine. She began making doughnuts with holes. Soon, claimed Gregory, everyone was doing it. At least that's the story, and no one seems to have disproved it. Number three, the Dutch weren't the only ones who brought doughnuts to New England. Many immigrant groups brought their own version of the donut across the Atlantic. For example, Italian Americans throughout New England celebrate St. Joseph's Day, March 19th, by binging on the luscious pastry known as zoppole. The saintly snack is a baked or fried donut with fillings such as cream, custard, or jelly, and topped with sugar or fruit. You can find them in many Italian bakeries, especially in Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Massachusetts. Punchki are filled Polish pastries, either glazed or dusted with sugar. Poles in Poland eat them on Fat Thursday, the Thursday before Ash Wednesday. But in the United States, Polish Americans tend to indulge in them on Fat Tuesday. Look for them in bakeries and heavily Polish communities like Chicopee, Massachusetts, or Bridgeport, Connecticut. In the southeastern Massachusetts cities of Fall River and New Bedford, Portuguese Americans celebrate Fat Tuesday with, you guessed it, sugar-coated donuts. They call them malasadas. The association of donuts with religious holidays has led some to refer to the Christian donut season. But Jews do it too, on Hanukkah, with fried dough rolled in sugar and injected with jelly. Loukoumenes, the Greek version of the donut, consists of deep fried dough balls soaked in honey, dusted with cinnamon, and sprinkled with chopped nuts. You can buy them at Loukoumenes at the Mall of New Hampshire in Manchester, New Hampshire, which has a sizable Greek population. In Hartford's Jamaican bakeries, you're likely to find Jamaican donuts called festivals, and you used to be able to get Berliners, a German favorite, at Carl's Sausage Kitchen, a German grocery store in Peabody, since 1958. It closed, regrettably, in 2025. Number 4. The Boston Cream Donut is the official donut of Massachusetts. Somerville Middle School student Emma Crane began her campaign for the donut's officialdom as a grade school student in 1997. She continued to lobby the great and general court with her classmates until Acting Governor Jane Swift made the Boston Cream Donut official with her signature on January 1, 2003. Such campaigns, to name official state cookies and fruits and the like, generally aim to teach school children about civics. It usually teaches them how long it takes to get a law passed. A month after the Boston Cream Donut achieved its elevated status, Dunkin' Donuts came out with a press release celebrating the news. The company also took the opportunity to promote its Boston Cream, which it then sold in about 800 shops in Massachusetts. The Boston Cream Donut is actually a Berliner filled with custard or cream patisserie and topped with chocolate icing. Only one other state, Louisiana, has an official state donut, the beignet. Number 5. The potato donut lives on in Maine. In the 1940s, a chain of donut shops called Spudnuts created a craze for potato donuts. It died out, however, and most Spudnuts have closed. But in Portland, Maine, the Holy Donut Shops keep the flame alive. Started by a single mom in 2012, Holy Donut was expanded to 4 shops in Greater Portland. They have a cult-like following, and tourists seek them out. Lines for the light, cakey donut are often out the door. Maine has a tradition of potato-infused sweets. The state's signature candy, the Needham, is also made with potato. Number 6. Two brothers-in-law founded Mr. Donuts and Dunkin' Donuts. They partnered to sell donuts, and then they broke up in 1955. Harry Winokur founded Mr. Donut in Boston, and Bill Rosenberg founded Dunkin' Donuts in Quincy, Massachusetts. Both companies expanded to hundreds of franchises, and eventually the company that bought Dunkin' Donuts bought Mr. Donut. Mr. Donut shops had the option of converting to Dunkin' Donuts. Today, Mr. Donut has all but disappeared from the United States. Only one domestic Mr. Donut survives, in Godfrey, Illinois, but the franchise has a large footprint in Asia. Japan has adopted Mr. Donut as its own. There's even a Mr. Donut Museum in Osaka called the Duskin Museum, after the company's mascot, a cute white dog. The museum features busts of the founders, retro memorabilia, short films, and two workshops, the Donut Making Experience and the Donut Topping Experience. Quincy, Massachusetts has a Dunkin' Donuts Museum. At least that's what Quincy locals call it. Though not an actual museum, it's the first Dunkin' Donuts eatery, started by Bill Rosenberg. Inside, a plaque reads, "This is the site of the original Dunkin' Donuts." It has pink and orange chairs and donut-shaped tables. Call it a living history museum. So following our recent snowstorm, I thought this next article might give a little perspective. It was also written by Leslie Ladrigan and published by the New England Historical Society. The title is Frozen Mercury and 18-Foot Drifts, Surviving the Cold Storm of 1857, New England's Worst Winter. The cold storm and great freeze of 1857 prostrated New England during the winter of 1856 to 57, one of the worst ever. 32 snowstorms dumped more than 6 feet of snow on the ground. Fierce winds created drifts as high as 18 feet, and it got so cold the mercury froze in thermometers. The frigid cold and heavy snow caused tremendous suffering and destruction, both during the winter and afterward. An untold number of people died. Some perished in shipwrecks, fires, or floods, while others departed quietly, borne away by cold or starvation. The bitter cold no doubt contributed to an influenza outbreak called one of the greatest epidemics and death. The property damage was immense, beginning with church spires blown away and ending with freshets that carried off buildings. High winds dashed dozens of ships against the shore and blew down houses. Commerce came to a halt, as snow paralyzed railroads and ice immobilized coastal navigation. Quote, "There was a tremendous winter," wrote steamboat historian Henry Whitmore in 1893. The weather in New England remained mild until mid-December, though plenty of snow had fallen. Then on December 17th, the temperature plummeted to 12 below zero in Massachusetts and 16 below in Maine. The next day was the coldest day New England had suffered in 22 years, with temperatures rising scarcely above zero anywhere in the region. It would get even colder. For the rest of the winter, violent wind and snowstorms buffeted New England. A snowstorm on December 23rd foretold what was to come. January opened with a storm on the 3rd, which made the railroads impassable. Sidney S. Ryder, editor of Book Notes, recalled that storm half a century later. He worked as a clerk in the bookstore of George H. Whitney in Westminster Street. It started on Saturday, snowed all night, and continued all the next day. Westminster Street was a bed of ice 2 feet thick for a month or more, he wrote. A Book Notes reader, W.A. Potter, remembered the next storm. On January 8, 1857, railroad trains were snowbound all over New England. On that day, not a train reached Providence until evening. Pawtucket omnibuses were unavailable to reach the city. Narragansett Bay was frozen solid to Newport, and a few persons skated to that city. No vessel arrived from outside for 10 days. On very cold days, New Englanders who lived in densely populated towns grew especially anxious about the threat of fire. During the cold storm and great freeze, fire gobbled a box factory in Cambridge, Massachusetts. the Claverick House in East Boston, Massachusetts, Dr. J. E. Hunt's house and outbuildings in Thomaston, Maine, and Joe Coe's dwelling house in Hitchcockville, Connecticut. In Laconia, New Hampshire, the railroad shops burned at the end of January. Quote, the temperature was 30 degrees below zero, and the firemen suffered severely, according to the fire department's history. The most spectacular fire that winter burned down Vermont's Granite State House. For 3 days, starting January 6th, temperatures had plunged below zero. At the beginning of that cold snap, a workman was heating the Vermont State House for a meeting the next day. After he closed the vents, the furnace got too hot. Flames then shot up through a floor register in Representatives Hall. The fire soon enveloped the dome. Townspeople helped firefighters by throwing chunks of ice and snow at the building. The fire seemed under control until the wind whipped up, scattering burning coals throughout the town. Only the heavy snow on nearby roofs prevented it from spreading. In the end, the inferno left only the granite walls standing. Vermont had to build a new state house. On Saturday, January 17th, an enormous cold weather system settled over swaths of the United States. By Sunday, it was 30 below at Muscatine, Iowa, 40 below in Watertown, New York, and 30 below at Woodstock, Vermont. That weekend began the worst 10 days of the worst winter in memory. People thought it was too cold to snow, reported the Cambridge Chronicle. They had it wrong. On Sunday night, a devastating snow hurricane, the cold storm, hit New England. A fierce northwest wind drove the snow. Quote, doubtless many persons, as they reluctantly crawled out of their warm nests to shiver in the sharp air of Monday morning, looked forth with surprise upon the drifted heaps that blocked their gates and doors, the Chronicle said. Quote, men were floundering through the snow up to their waists, reported the Chronicle. Women only peeped out at the window, and rail cars stood still. In Connecticut, between 2 and 3 feet of snow fell, and all travel stopped, according to the Illustrated Commercial, Mechanical, Professional, and Statistical Gazetteer. On Monday, the gale turned into a perfect tempest and blew down the Chapel Street Church spire in New Haven, prostrated 2 lofty spires in Waterbury, and caused much other damage. The Bark Tedesco, headed for Boston, wrecked off Swampscott, Massachusetts. All hands lost. In Provincetown, gale-force winds drove 17 vessels onto the beach. The wind also demolished a house in New Bedford. 2 schooners and a sloop went ashore at Owl's Head, and the storm blocked the roads in Thomaston, Maine. After the cold storm, drifts on the Cape Cod railroad tracks rose as high as 18 feet. In Essex, Massachusetts, drifts rose above the windows of William Perkins' good-sized 2-story house, the Pittsfield Sun reported. The Perkins family had to look at the clock to find out whether morning had arrived yet. One of the neighbors shoveled away the snow so Perkins could climb out of the window. In Providence, Sidney Ryder remembered the tremendous amount of snow. Quote, when I reached Mr. Whitney's shop, that snowdrift was 17 feet high, and the boys had pierced it with a hole through which the boys had led a horse, unhitched from a nearby carting wagon, he wrote. That was one of the few businesses that did open after the cold storm. Many didn't. The trains didn't run, and ships froze in harbors all along the coast. People did without the bread, meat, and milk ordinarily delivered to their door because draft horses couldn't make it through the snow. In the Connecticut River Valley, the cost of food skyrocketed. Quote, the factory has been developed at the expense of the farm. Provisions were coming in from the west, and the Connecticut Valley was not feeding itself, wrote Springfield historian Mason Arnold Green. The poor suffered terribly for the want of food, and many churches took up collections for them, wrote Salem historian Sidney Perley. The Great Freeze of 1857 continued after the storm. On January 19th, the day of the cold storm, the mercury froze in the thermometer in Franconia, New Hampshire, and registered 50 below zero in the Vermont towns of Montpelier and St. Johnsbury. Quote, the air was very thin and peculiarly transparent and light, and the sky, therefore, remarkably clear, wrote Perley. Steamboats had to break the ice on Long Island Sound, which froze for a month. The harbor at New Haven is frozen as tight as Baffin's Bay, reported the Hartford Times on January 27th. Captain Merrow of the schooner Daniel Trowbridge, who has been for a week frozen in near Southwest Ledge at the mouth of New Haven Harbor, reports that nothing but ice can be seen from his topmast with a spyglass. Narragansett Bay was frozen tight, with ice 14 inches thick on Pawtucket Bar as late as mid-March. The ice blockage lasted so long that the Providence textile mills started to run out of cotton. Quote, there was plenty at Newport, and the commercial steamboat company resolved to break through the ice and get that cotton, wrote Whittemore. Captain Williams took charge of the Curlew, a very strong boat. The Curlew broke through the ice and towed the cotton in bales. In New Hampshire, Portsmouth Harbor froze over for the first time in memory. So did Boston Harbor. On January 28th, Henry David Thoreau saw vessels frozen in the ice. Quote, saw thousands on the ice, he wrote in his journal, a stream of men reaching down to Fort Independence, where they were cutting a channel toward the city. Ice said to reach 14 miles. Snow untracked on many decks. The ice didn't go out until February 15th, he noted. On January 31st, it snowed in Mexico City, an extremely rare phenomenon. Then came a thaw in February and two great rainstorms, which brought another set of problems. Tremendous freshets washed away buildings and bridges from Connecticut to Maine. In Connecticut, the Housatonic River flooded, carrying off bridges. The floodwaters rose to the top of the Manufacturers Bank vault. After the flood subsided, bank officers couldn't find a dry note of paper in the building. The Shetucket River in Norwich flooded the waterfront and caused tremendous property damage. In Castleton, Vermont, an avalanche destroyed the barn and wagon shed belonging to Marilyn Clark on February 22nd. Ice and snow filled the Clark's house and buried a baby in its cradle, but the child survived unhurt. Flooding came later in Maine. On April 16th, for example, a Kennebec River freshet caused damage up and down the river, carrying away the toll bridge at Waterville and a railroad bridge in Shohegan. During March and April, the weather seesawed between balmy and fiercely cold. Then, on April 21st, Connecticut got hit by another great snowstorm. It started as rain, then turned to snow, dumping as much as 2 feet on southern Connecticut. The storm system whitened the streets in Baltimore, but in Bartlett, New Hampshire, heavy rains washed away every bridge. Then, just when everyone thought the winter had ended, ice formed in Litchfield County, Connecticut, on Sunday, May 17th. I know many readers and listeners of Audio Journal depend on Social Security checks, so I thought this next article was interesting and informative. It was also written by Leslie Landrigan and published by the New England Historical Society. It's titled, Ida Mae Fuller gets the first Social Security check. Ida Mae Fuller of Ludlow, Vermont, received the first Social Security check on January 31, 1940. The check was numbered 00-00-001, the first of the first batch of 220,000 checks issued to adults as well as children. Born on a farm outside of Ludlow, Ida Mae Fuller attended the Black River Academy in Rutland, Vermont, 3 years behind Calvin Coolidge. She worked for a while as a schoolteacher, then in 1905 began work as a legal secretary. She never married. Between 1937 and her retirement in 1939, she paid a total of $24.75 in Social Security payroll taxes. While running an errand on November 4, 1939, she dropped by the Rutland Social Security office to inquire. Urged to apply for benefits, she filed her claim. Quote, "It wasn't that I expected anything, mind you, but I knew I'd been paying for something called Social Security, and I wanted to ask the people in Rutland about it," she said. That first Social Security check was for $22.54, nearly what she had paid into the system. Some critics thought it suspicious that a Vermonter received the first check because John Winant, former New Hampshire governor, was the first head of the Social Security Board. But it was another New Englander who made sure Ida Mae Fuller got her check. Frances Perkins, President Franklin Roosevelt's Secretary of Labor. Perkins was born in Boston, grew up in Worcester, and summered at her family homestead in Newcastle, Maine. Her ancestors included Revolutionary War orator James Otis. Perkins persuaded Franklin Roosevelt to ride the wave of Townsend clubs to support a federal retirement program for workers. California physician Francis Townsend started the clubs after he saw three elderly women rooting through a garbage can for food. During the Great Depression, more than half of older Americans were poor. Thousands of Townsend clubs pressured Congress to pass an old age pension plan. Sensing the opportunity, Roosevelt acquiesced to Perkins' demand. He assigned her to run the committee that would craft the legislation. As soon as the Social Security Act passed, conservatives in Congress began to attack it as unconstitutional. Frances Perkins had made sure it would withstand judicial scrutiny. Months before Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act on August 14, 1935, she consulted with Supreme Court Justice Harlan Stone, a native of Chesterfield, New Hampshire. Kirsten Downey describes what happened in her biography of Perkins. At an afternoon part at Stone's home, Frances was drinking tea with the justice when he asked her how things were going. She told him they were wrestling with how to establish an economic security program. Stone looked around to see if anyone was listening, then leaned in toward Frances. "The taxing power, my dear, the taxing power," he said in quiet tones. The Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the Social Security Act. Though Ida Mae Fuller had paid into Social Security for only 3 years, she received monthly checks until her death on January 27, 1975, at 100 years old. She received a total of $22,888 from Social Security. During her last 8 years, Ida Mae Fuller lived with her niece in Brattleboro, Vermont. Near the end of her life, she told a reporter her Social Security benefits come pretty near paying for my expenses. She was described in 1955 as a, quote, "kindly, likable, practical, and placid woman whose ability to derive deep satisfaction from simple, wholesome living has eased her through life. But as a Republican, she hadn't voted for Franklin Roosevelt. Maple syrup season is quickly approaching, so I thought this next article would be pretty interesting. It's titled, From Sugar Houses to the Sugar Trust, Boston's Candy-Colored History. This article was written by Rebecca Rector and was published by the New England Historical Society. Colonial Boston had a sweet tooth, and sugar played an important part of the local economy during that time. Dozens, if not hundreds, of Boston artisans worked as independent sugar refiners inside sugar houses. These entrepreneurs, called sugar bakers, supplied coffee houses and tea rooms. Over time, they made Boston the center of candy making. Later, large refineries were built and belonged to a powerful cartel in the 1880s. Before the era of industrial refining, sugar was processed by small businesses called sugar bakeries. Boston had many of them. The early method of processing sugar involved boiling it in large copper pots called coppers. Sometimes sugar bakers used 4 or 5 pots in different phases of production. It was a thriving business. Merchants like John Hancock imported raw sugar from the West Indies, where slave plantations grew sugarcane. Boston had a robust trade with them, part of the triangular trade. The transatlantic triangle trade began with Europeans trading manufactured goods for enslaved people in Africa. Those captives were shipped to work on West Indian sugar plantations. New England merchants then supplied the plantations with commodities like dried fish and lumber, returning to North America with molasses and raw sugar. Notably, French and Dutch Caribbean sugar from islands like Martinique and Saint Dominique were cheaper than sugar from the British West Isles. In 1764, the Crown levied a tax on the importation of sugar and molasses from the non-British sources in the West Indies. Hancock criticized the tax, and the next year he entered politics by winning election as a Boston selectman. The sugar bakers likely supported Hancock. Ezekiel Cheever, an early Boston sugar baker, had a role in the American Revolution. Born in Charlestown, a descendant of Ezekiel Cheever, the colonial schoolmaster, he was appointed to protect the Boston Tea Party participants in 1773. During the war, he worked closely with General Henry Knox as commissary of artillery stores, ordnance equipment. He was buried in Granary Burial Ground in 1793. There must have been several Ezekiels in the sugar business during that time. Quote, How Sweet It Is, A History of Sugar and Sugar Refining in the U.S. by Virginia Mesker states that Boston tax rolls show an Ezekiel Cheever sugar refinery in Charlestown from 1721 to 1766. The book, Crooked and Narrow Streets of Boston, 1630 to 1822, by Anne Haven Thwing, mentioned several sugar businesses, such as that of Thomas Child, distiller and sugar baker at the corner of Essex and Kingston Streets in the 1730s. Opposite Franklin Avenue was the sugar house of James Smith and James Murray, which was used for barracks by the British during the siege, she wrote. Sugar bakers used a multi-step process to produce refined white sugar. Raw sugar from the sugar cane was purchased from Cuba. First, it had to be washed to remove the molasses, which was sold for the rum trade, then crystallized, dried, and formed into cone-shaped loaves. Boston's many sugar houses spawned new businesses. In 1764, Dr. James Baker and Irish chocolatier John Hannon started the first chocolate factory in America. Their water-powered grist mill on the Neponset River became the Baker's Chocolate Company. The Schraft Candy Company in 1861 introduced jelly beans and urged customers to send them to Civil War soldiers. Later, the company made boxed chocolates and started a chain of restaurants. Although independent sugar bakers continued to exist for several decades, larger refineries began to appear in the 1830s. The Boston Sugar Refinery was established on Lewis Street between Webster and Sumner in East Boston in 1834. Powered by a steam engine, it employed 80 people. This boiling and drying process was on a much larger scale than in colonial days. Later, South Boston's Charles Hershey patented a drying machine called a granulator in 1871. The invention led to Boston's success as a candy maker. You may remember Nico, the New England Candy Company wafers, Mary Jane's, and Squirrel Nut Zippers, all made in the Boston area. The East Boston Directory of 1852 listed 41 sugar bakers, most of them on Sumner or Everett Street. Many of them also appear in the 1850 census of East Boston, where 38 sugar bakers, all born in Germany, lived at the same address. These men probably worked in one of the larger refineries and lived in nearby factory houses. In 1887, the Boston Refinery belonged to the Sugar Trust, a monopoly that took advantage of protective tariffs to control the market. Henry O. Havemeyer, a third-generation sugar refiner, formed the trust. Comprised of 17 mostly East Coast sugar refineries, it included four in Boston. The Sugar Trust had a 98% monopoly and was highly controversial for its predatory pricing, political influence, and fraud. It even won a Supreme Court case in 1895. The High Court ruled that the Trust did not violate the Sherman Antitrust Act, which prohibited monopolies in trade and commerce. Thus, this sugar monopoly survived because the court considered refining a local activity and not subject to interstate commerce regulations. Boston's Edwin F. Atkins was involved in the Sugar Trust and served as vice president and president after Havemeyer's death in 1907. Atkins, a Boston businessman, managed Cuban sugar purchases for his family business, and he also managed the Bay State Sugar Refining Company. A 2023 Boston Globe article called him the Sugar Baron of Boston. Another Bostonian, John Perrin Spalding, also had a role in the Sugar Trust. He had established the Revere Sugar Refinery in 1871 in Charlestown. Spalding was also a philanthropist, an early benefactor of Helen Keller, and was known throughout Boston as the Sugar King. His Revere Refinery initially remained independent of the Sugar Trust, but Boston-based United Fruit, now Chiquita Brands International, absorbed and finally acquired the business. The Sugar Trust evolved into the American Sugar Refining Company. It then dominated the United States sugar industry for much of the 20th century, and Domino became one of its brands. By 1960, American Sugar Refining Company built a new plant in Charlestown to replace the one in South Boston. According to the Boston Globe in April 1961, commencing today, the American Sugar Refining Company rededicates itself to a brand new era of service to Domino's friends throughout Boston, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and all of New England. The Domino brand has since gone through many ownership changes, but you can still find that familiar yellow and white bag of sugar on grocery shelves. This seems like a good time to introduce a story about the origins of Friday the 13th. This article appeared on History.com. Long considered a harbinger of bad luck, Friday the 13th has inspired a late 19th century secret society, an early 20th century novel, a horror film franchise. Just like walking under a ladder, crossing paths with a black cat, or breaking a mirror, many people hold fast to the belief that Friday the 13th brings bad luck. Though it's uncertain exactly when this particular tradition began, negative superstitions have swirled around the number 13 for centuries. While Western cultures have historically associated the number 12 with completeness, there are 12 days of Christmas, 12 months, and zodiac signs, 12 labors of Hercules, 12 gods of Olympus, and 12 tribes of Israel, just to name a few examples. Its successor, 13, has a long history as a sign of bad luck. The ancient code of Hammurabi, for example, reportedly admitted a 13th law from its list of legal rules. Though this was probably a clerical error, superstitious people sometimes point to this as proof of 13's long-standing negative associations. According to biblical traditions, 13 guests attended the Last Supper, held on Maundy Thursday, including Jesus and his 12 apostles, one of whom, Judas, betrayed him. The next day, of course, was Good Friday, the day of Jesus' crucifixion. The seating arrangement at the Last Supper is believed to have given rise to a long-standing Christian superstition that having 13 guests at a table was a bad omen, specifically that it was courting death. Though Friday's negative associations are weaker, some have suggested they also have roots in Christian tradition. Just as Jesus was crucified on a Friday, Friday was also said to be the day Eve gave Adam the fateful apple from the tree of knowledge, as well as the day Cain killed his brother Abel. In the late 19th century, a New Yorker named Captain William Fowler sought to remove the enduring stigma surrounding the number 13, and particularly the unwritten rule about not having 13 guests at a dinner table, by founding an exclusive society called the 13 Club. The group dined regularly on the 13th day of the month in room 13 of the Knickerbocker Cottage, a popular watering hole Fowler owned from 1863 to 1883. Before sitting down for a 13-course dinner, members would pass beneath a ladder and a banner reading Morituri to Salutamus, Latin for, "Those of us who are about to die salute you." Four former U.S. presidents, Chester A. Arthur, Grover Cleveland, Benjamin Harrison, and Theodore Roosevelt, would join the 13 Club's ranks at one time or another. An important milestone in the history of the Friday the 13th legend in particular, not just the number 13, occurred in 1907 with the publication of the novel Friday the 13th, written by Thomas William Lawson. The books told the story of a New York City stockbroker who plays on superstitions about the date to create chaos on Wall Street and make a killing on the market. The horror movie Friday the 13th, released in 1980, introduced the world to a hockey mask-wearing killer named Jason, and is perhaps the best-known example of the famous superstition in pop culture history. The movie spawned multiple sequels, as well as comic books, novellas, video games, related merchandise, and countless terrifying Halloween costumes. On Friday the 13th, 1307, officers of King Philip IV of France arrested hundreds of Knights Templar, a powerful religious and military order formed in the 12th century for the defense of the Holy Land. Imprisoned on charges of various illegal behaviors, but really because the king wanted access to their financial resources, many Templars were later executed. Some cite the link with the Templars as the origin of the Friday the 13th superstitions, but like many legends involving the Templars and their history, the truth remains murky. In more recent times, a number of traumatic events have occurred on Friday the 13th, including the German bombing of Buckingham Palace, September 1940, the murder of Kitty Genovese in Queens, New York, March 1964, a cyclone that killed more than 300,000 people in Bangladesh, November 1970, the disappearance of a Chilean Air Force plane in the Andes in October 1972, the death of rapper Tupac Shakur, September 1996, and the crash of the Costa Concordia cruise ship off the coast of Italy, which killed 30 people, January of 2012. You've been listening to All Things History, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org. Or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. This is Doug Johnson, and if you're a history buff, we would love to hear your thoughts and ideas on an interesting topic for us to investigate. Thanks for listening.
Audio Journal, the radio reading service of Central Massachusetts, serving visually and print-impaired listeners since 1987. Audio Journal is a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
This is Bird Note. The fluting song of the wood thrush is an ethereal sound of summer in North America. From April to September, these robin-sized songsters serenade deciduous forests of the eastern U.S. and Canada. Each fall, they migrate to rainforests from southern Mexico to Panama, where they call to each other from the underbrush. For wood thrushes, not just any woods will do. They depend on large blocks of intact forest throughout their range. Unfortunately, wood thrushes are losing habitat as humans convert vibrant forests to pastures, mines, and urban developments. As the remaining forests become smaller and scattered, the wood thrush are left with less food and more threats from predators. We can help wood thrushes and forest birds everywhere by conserving and restoring woodlands throughout the Americas. That includes planting native trees in urban green spaces and buying bird-friendly coffee that's cultivated without destroying the crucial habitats that support the wood thrush's priceless song. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Support comes from Wild Delight Bird Food, offering a variety of blends designed to mimic the natural resources wild birds crave. Available at Chewy.com.